A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking two questions that kind of sit at opposite ends of the same spectrum. First, how many countries in the world essentially have no standing army at all? And second, along that long tail of global military strength, at what point does a military go from being small to actually notable in terms of personnel count? It's a great framing, because we spend so much time talking about the giants, the EU, China, Russia, and almost no time looking at what it means to have nothing, or almost nothing.
The number of countries with no army is way higher than most people assume. I was digging through the CII World Factbook and SIPRI data for this, and as of right now, mid-2026, there are about 23 UN-recognized sovereign states with populations over 100,000 that have no standing army at all.
I would have guessed maybe 8, 10 at the outside. Maybe I'd remember Costa Rica and Iceland, then start guessing Caribbean islands and hope for the best.
Most people guess even lower, and the reasons vary wildly. Some have constitutional bans, some just never rebuilt after a conflict, and some are effectively sheltered under a larger power's umbrella. So let's start with the obvious question. What does it actually mean to have no military?
Because there's a difference between we literally have zero armed personnel, and we technically have no army. But also there are 20,000 people with guns who work for the state.
So the definitional boundary matters. When we say no standing army, we mean no permanent professional military force intended for external defense. These countries might still have police forces, coast guards, border patrols, or even paramilitary civil guards. Costa Rica is the poster child here. They abolished their military in 1949 after a civil war, and Article 12 of their constitution literally says, quote, "The army is prohibited as a permanent institution." But they maintain a roughly 20,000-strong police force and a small civil guard. That's not a military in the classic sense, but it's not nothing.
They've got the fire extinguisher, but not the fire department.
That's actually a perfect way to put it, and the fire extinguisher works because they're not in a high-threat neighborhood. Costa Rica spends about 1.5% of GDP on education, double the regional average, and has the highest human development index in Central America. That's what some economists call the demilitarization dividend. Money that would have gone to tanks goes to textbooks, and in a stable region with strong diplomatic ties, that math works.
Of course, stable region with strong diplomatic ties is doing a lot of work in that sentence. Put Costa Rica in the South China Sea, and the math looks different.
And that's the core trade-off. Let's get specific. Here are the countries that have made this choice, and why. I'd break them into roughly three categories. First, constitutional bans, Costa Rica, Japan, and Panama. Panama abolished its military in 1990, right after the EU invasion removed Noriega. Their constitution now explicitly prohibits a standing army. Second category, post-conflict decisions. These are mostly small island states that had some form of colonial or post-colonial force, disbanded it, and never rebuilt. Samoa, Vanuatu, the Solomon Islands, St. Vincent, and the Grenadines. Third category, and this is the one I find most interesting, geopolitical shelter. Iceland and Liechtenstein both have essentially no military, but both are protected by larger powers.
Iceland is the one that always surprises people. NATO member, no army.
No army since 1869. They joined NATO in 1949, founding member, and the EU maintained an airbase at Keflavik until 2006. Today, Iceland's entire military capability is the Icelandic Coast Guard. About 100 personnel. That's it. They have a bilateral defense agreement with the EU, and NATO covers the rest. It's a case study in what international relations scholars call free riding on alliance security guarantees, though they don't love that phrase in Reykjavik.
They prefer strategic burden-sharing optimization.
I'm sure they do. But the point stands, Iceland spends essentially zero on defense and gets the same Article 5 protection as a country spending 4% of GDP. It's a brilliant geopolitical hack, assuming your allies stay reliable. And this is where the model gets fragile. If NATO fractures, if the EU commitment wavers, Iceland's entire defense strategy collapses overnight. They have no plan B. There is no Icelandic resistance force waiting in the fjords. The Coast Guard isn't repelling an invasion. The entire bet is that the alliance holds.
That's the thing about geopolitical shelter. It's not a permanent structure. It's a lease. The landlord can change the terms, or sell the building, or just stop answering the phone. How does Iceland think about that risk in 2026?
Not publicly, at least not in a way that suggests they're losing sleep. But privately, I think there's more anxiety than they let on. The 2024 EU presidential election, the shifting NATO burden-sharing debates, these are not abstract conversations in Reykjavik. They're existential. If the EU ever says, we're done subsidizing European defense, Iceland is Exhibit A for the prosecution.
Which brings us to Japan. Because Japan is the category breaker. They have Article 9 of the 1947 Constitution, which renounces war and the threat or use of force as means of settling international disputes. That sounds like no military. But the Japan Self-Defense Forces have 247,000 active personnel. That's the 8th largest military in the world by headcount. Bigger than the UK's army.
Yeah, Japan is the elephant in the no army room. The JSDF is a military in every functional sense. Ground, maritime, air branches, advanced fighter jets, Aegis destroyers, amphibious units. The constitutional fiction has been stretched so far, it's basically transparent. And the 2015 security legislation reinterpretation was the real watershed. For the first time since World War II, Japan can engage in collective self-defense, meaning the JSDF can fight abroad to protect allies, not just defend Japanese territory.
They're on the list technically, but practically they're not.
And most serious analysts don't include Japan when they talk about countries with no army. The JSDF is a notable military by any measure. But the constitutional ban is still there, which creates this bizarre situation where Japan has one of the world's most capable armed forces and also a legal document that says armed forces are illegal. It's the constitutional equivalent of having a no-pets lease and an 80-pound Labrador in the living room.
The Labrador of collective self-defense.
And the landlord has just decided not to look at the dog. For decades, the Japanese government's position was essentially, the JSDF is not a military, it's a self-defense organization, and we're not going to define that too carefully. Every time they acquire a new capability, aerial refueling tankers, helicopter carriers, amphibious assault units, they perform this elaborate interpretive dance to explain why it's still consistent with Article 9. At some point, the dance becomes the policy.
How long can that fiction hold? Is there a serious constitutional amendment movement in Japan right now?
There's been a serious movement for 20 years, and it's never quite gotten over the line. Prime Minister Kishida pushed for it, and the current administration is still talking about it. But the hurdle is enormous. You need a two-thirds majority in both houses of parliament, plus a majority in a national referendum. The Japanese public is more open to constitutional revision than they were a generation ago, partly because of North Korean missile tests and Chinese assertiveness in the East China Sea, but there's still deep unease about formally scrapping Article 9. So they'll probably keep stretching the fiction rather than replacing it.
The Labrador gets its own room and nobody calls it a kennel.
Now, there are also some messy cases worth flagging. Haiti disbanded its army in 1995. But then Minustach, the UN stabilization mission, effectively served as its military for over a decade, and recently Haiti has been trying to reconstitute a small force. Grenada has had no army since the 1983 EU invasion, but it maintains a roughly 100-person paramilitary unit. These are edge cases. The clean list is about 23 countries with genuinely no standing army.
Some of these are microstates. You said we're excluding anything under 100,000 population.
Yeah, otherwise, you get Vatican City, Monaco, Nauru, Tuvalu, places where the entire population could fit in a football stadium. The interesting question is sovereign states of meaningful size that made a deliberate choice to have no military. And the takeaway from the first part of this is that it's almost always a combination of three things. A constitutional or political decision, a benign neighborhood, and a powerful patron.
The trifecta of demilitarization. Lose any one of those legs and the stool falls over.
We've seen that happen. Ukraine gave up its nuclear arsenal in 1994 under the Budapest Memorandum, with security assurances from Russia, the EU, and the UK. That was supposed to be the patron leg of the stool. We all know how that worked out.
A masterclass in what not to do. And it's worth pausing on that, because Ukraine is the cautionary tale that haunts every conversation about demilitarization. They didn't abolish their army. They kept a substantial force, but they surrendered the ultimate deterrent. 1,900 nuclear warheads, the third largest arsenal on Earth at the time, and they traded them for a piece of paper that turned out to be worth less than the ink it was printed with. If you're a small country watching that play out in real time, what lesson do you draw?
The lesson is that security guarantees from great powers are only as good as the willingness of those powers to enforce them, and that willingness can change with a single election. Ukraine's experience has probably set back the cause of nuclear non-proliferation by a generation. If I'm sitting in Seoul or Warsaw or Riyadh, I'm looking at Ukraine and thinking, the only guarantee that actually works is the one you provide yourself. That doesn't necessarily mean nuclear weapons. It could mean drones, cyber capabilities, a highly mobilized reserve force, but it definitely doesn't mean trusting a patron.
That's the dark side of the trifecta. If you can't trust the patron leg, you have to build your own stool, which means you need a military. Which brings us to the second question.
If 23 countries have zero soldiers, the next question is, at what point does a military actually matter? When does small become notable?
This is the part of the prompt I really like, because it forces us to define what notable even means. Notable to whom? Notable for what? A military that can defend its borders is different from one that can project power, which is different from one that can deter a nuclear adversary.
That's why pure personnel count is increasingly a bad metric, but let's start with it anyway, because it gives us a framework. I've been looking at the 2025 IISS military balance data, and I think there's a useful taxonomy. Tier 1, what I'd call micro-militaries. Under 5,000 active personnel, this is Luxembourg with 900, Belize with 1,500, Fiji with 3,500. These forces are essentially ceremonial or constabulary. They can do disaster relief, border patrol, maybe contribute a platoon to a UN peacekeeping mission, but they have zero power projection capability. No independent air force, no navy to speak of, no ability to sustain operations beyond their borders.
Luxembourg's 900 personnel. That's smaller than some American high schools.
Yet Luxembourg is a NATO member. They contribute in niche ways. They have a reconnaissance satellite program. They specialize in cyber. But in terms of boots on ground, 900 people is not a military in any meaningful operational sense. It's a military as a diplomatic credential.
A membership card that comes with a gun. And this is where the taxonomy gets interesting, because Luxembourg's 900 personnel and Fiji's 3,500 are both in Tier 1, but they're doing very different things. Fiji is one of the largest contributors to UN peacekeeping per capita in the world. They've had troops in the Golan Heights, Sinai, Iraq, Lebanon. For a country of less than 1 million people, that's a serious operational tempo. So is Fiji's military notable? In a way, Luxembourg's isn't.
That's a fair pushback. Fiji is an exception in Tier 1 because they've carved out a specific niche, peacekeeping as a national export. Fijian soldiers are well regarded. They get UN reimbursement rates that flow back into the Fijian economy, and it's a source of national prestige. But the capability ceiling is still low. Fiji can't independently deploy those troops. They rely on UN logistics, airlift from larger powers, and they have no ability to sustain combat operations against a near-peer adversary. So they're notable within a narrow band of peacekeeping, but they're not notable in the sense of being able to shape a conflict.
Tier 1 is a spectrum from purely symbolic to niche player, but nobody in this tier is defending their borders against a serious threat without help.
Tier 2, small militaries, 5,000 to 50,000 active personnel. This is where things get real. Ireland at about 9,500, New Zealand at 9,000, Denmark at 17,000, Norway at 23,000. These forces can defend national borders, at least against non-major power threats, and they can contribute meaningfully to coalition operations. New Zealand's SAS is world-class. Denmark's frigates patrol the North Atlantic, but they cannot sustain expeditionary warfare on their own. If New Zealand wanted to conduct an amphibious landing somewhere, they'd need a ride from someone else.
Ireland is an interesting case here, because they're militarily neutral, but not defenseless. 9,500 personnel, mostly focused on peacekeeping and territorial defense. They've contributed to UN missions for decades.
They punch above their weight in certain specialized areas. The Irish Army Ranger Wing is highly regarded, but 9,500 active personnel means they have, what, maybe 3 or 4 deployable battalions? That's enough for peacekeeping, not for fighting a war. The thing about Ireland is that their neutrality is credible precisely because nobody is threatening to invade them. If that changed, if the strategic environment deteriorated, 9,500 personnel would start to look very thin very fast.
This is where the conversation gets uncomfortable for a lot of small neutral countries. Neutrality isn't a magic shield. It's a policy choice that works when your neighbors respect it. If they stop respecting it, you need a military that can make them reconsider. 9,500 soldiers doesn't make anyone reconsider.
Tier 3 is where I put the notable threshold. 50,000 to 250,000 active personnel. This is Australia at 60,000, the Netherlands at 41,000, and then the case that really defines this tier, Israel at 170,000 active and 465,000 reserves.
Israel is the poster child for personnel count, doesn't tell the whole story. 170,000 active is smaller than Pakistan's army, smaller than Iran's, but the capability gap is enormous.
Because Israel has independent air, land, sea, cyber, and space capabilities. It can project force regionally, sustain brigade-level operations, and has a domestic defense industrial base that produces everything from small arms to satellite systems. That's what makes a military notable, not just the headcount, but the ability to operate across multiple domains independently. The 2025 IISS military balance pegs the global median military size at about 35,000 active personnel. That means half the world's militaries are smaller than that. The inflection point where you start seeing truly independent multi-domain capability is around 50,000.
50,000 is the Mendoza line of military significance.
Below 50,000, you're probably dependent on allies for at least one domain: airlift, strategic reconnaissance, naval power projection. Above 50,000, you can start to do things yourself. But here's where it gets interesting. The historical context flips this on its head. In 1900, a force of 20,000 was considered major. The British Expeditionary Force at the start of World War I was about 100,000. Today, 20,000 is Denmark. Mechanization, air power, and nuclear weapons raised the bar dramatically throughout the 20th century. But now, in the 2020s, technology is lowering it again.
Fouled. Drones and cyber.
Drones and cyber. The 2026 Ukraine war has been the definitive demonstration. Ukraine doesn't have the largest army in Europe, but its drone capabilities, everything from modified commercial quadcopters to long-range one-way attack drones, have allowed it to attrit a much larger Russian conventional force. Personnel count is becoming less predictive of combat effectiveness every year.
This connects to something we've talked about before, the shift from mass-based warfare to network-based capability. A small force that can see the battlefield, communicate in real time, and strike precisely is worth more than a large force that's blind and slow.
Estonia is the perfect case study. 7,000 active personnel. That's tier 2, small by any measure. But they have 60,000 reserves, and more importantly, they have a world-leading cyber command that's been operational since 2018. NATO considers Estonia a notable contributor despite the tiny active force, because in a conflict with Russia, Estonia's cyber capabilities would be disproportionately valuable. They also host the NATO Cooperative Cyber Defense Center of Excellence in Tallinn.
7,000 active personnel, but they basically weaponize their entire digital infrastructure. That's the network to soldier ratio in action. And this is where I want to push on the taxonomy a bit. If Estonia is tier 2 by headcount, but tier 3 by capability, is our taxonomy already obsolete?
It's obsolete in the sense that personnel count alone is a bad classifier, but it's still useful as a starting point because headcount correlates with budget, and budget correlates with options. Estonia's Cyber Command is exceptional, but Estonia still can't do independent air superiority. They don't have fighter jets. They rely on NATO for air policing. So even a highly sophisticated Tier 2 country has domain gaps that a true Tier 3 country doesn't. The taxonomy holds if you use it as a multi-factor framework rather than a single number.
So Estonia is Tier 2 with a Tier 3 asterisk in one domain.
Singapore takes a different approach, but reaches a similar conclusion. 72,000 active personnel, that's solidly Tier 3, but the real story is the reserves. 350,000 reservists, and Singapore can mobilize them within 48 hours. That's the fastest mobilization rate in Asia. The 2026 Global Firepower Index ranks Singapore 24th overall, ahead of countries with 10 times its personnel. Because Singapore invests massively in technology, training, and integration, their Air Force flies F-15 SGs and F-35s. Their Navy operates submarines and frigates. For a country of 5.6 million people, that's extraordinary.
A city-state that decided to become a porcupine.
A very expensive porcupine. Singapore spends about 3% of GDP on defense, but the point is, 72,000 active personnel doesn't capture Singapore's military power. You have to look at reserves, technology, alliances, and industrial base. And that's the real answer to the second question. The threshold where a military becomes notable is not a single personnel number, it's a capability threshold.
What's the capability threshold? If you were advising a defense analyst, what would you tell them to look for?
First, independent multi-domain operations. Can the country operate in air, land, sea, cyber, and space without relying on an ally for one of those domains? Second, sustainability. Can it keep fighting for more than a few weeks? That means logistics, maintenance, and a domestic or reliable foreign supply chain. Third, deterrence credibility. Does the force structure match the actual threats the country faces? Israel's force structure deters Iran and Hezbollah. Singapore's deters Malaysia and Indonesia. Estonia's is designed to make a Russian invasion costly enough that NATO has time to respond.
That third one is the one I think gets overlooked most often. Deterrence credibility isn't about beating the adversary. It's about making the cost of attacking you higher than whatever the adversary hopes to gain. A small country doesn't need to win a war. It just needs to make the war not worth starting. That's the porcupine strategy in a nutshell.
It's why the personnel number is so misleading. If your deterrent strategy is, we will make this so painful, you'll regret it, you don't necessarily need a large standing army. You need a mobilization system that works, a population that's willing to fight, and a few sharp teeth, cyber, drones, anti-ship missiles, whatever, that can inflict disproportionate damage. Singapore's 350,000 reservists aren't there to invade anyone. They're there to make an invasion of Singapore a nightmare.
If you look at the 2026 landscape, the countries that are adapting fastest are the small ones. The superpowers are burdened by legacy systems, bureaucratic inertia, and the sheer cost of maintaining million-person forces. Meanwhile, a country like Estonia can reorient around cyber and drones in a matter of years.
The 2026 NATO summit is reportedly discussing a new cyber personnel category for force planning, essentially counting cyber operators alongside infantry. That's a recognition that the definition of military personnel is expanding. An Estonian cyber operator sitting in Tallinn can have more strategic impact than a battalion of motorized infantry.
Which raises the provocative question, could a country like Costa Rica defend itself with a drone fleet and no soldiers at all?
I think the honest answer is not yet, but the trajectory is pointing that way. If you had a network of autonomous surveillance drones, ground-based air defense systems, and cyber capabilities, you could make an invasion costly enough that it might not be worth it, especially if you're in a region where no one has a burning desire to invade you. Costa Rica's real defense isn't drones, it's the fact that Nicaragua and Panama aren't existential threats, and the EU would probably intervene if someone tried anything.
The geopolitical shelter point again.
It always comes back to that. So what does this mean for how we think about military power in 2026? I think there are three actionable takeaways. First, for countries considering demilitarization or radical downsizing, Costa Rica's model works, but only with strong regional alliances and a functioning internal security apparatus. Costa Rica didn't just abolish the army and hope for the best. They built a robust police force, invested in education, and cultivated diplomatic relationships. It's not a one-size-fits-all solution. Try this in the Middle East and you'd be gone in a week.
The don't try this at home caveat.
Second takeaway, the notable threshold is shifting from personnel to capability. A 10,000-person force with drones, cyber units, and precision munitions is more notable than a 100,000-person force with Cold War equipment sitting in warehouses. The 2026 Ukraine war has made this irrefutable. Russian personnel counts are massive, but their combat effectiveness has been degraded by poor training, corruption, and an inability to adapt to drone warfare. Ukraine's smaller, more networked force has held them off.
Third takeaway, and this is the one I think defense analysts are still grappling with. The key metric is no longer how many soldiers, but how many networked kill chains. A kill chain is the process from identifying a target to destroying it. If you can close that loop faster than your adversary, you win. And a small force with good sensors and fast decision loops can close kill chains faster than a large force with a sclerotic command structure.
The IISS noted this in their 2025 report. Personnel count correlates poorly with combat effectiveness in modern warfare. The correlation between defense spending and capability is stronger, but even that misses things like training quality, doctrine, and network architecture. Singapore spends less in absolute terms than Saudi Arabia, but I know which military I'd rather have on my side.
The Saudi military is a cautionary tale. Massive spending, top-tier equipment, and a track record of operational mediocrity in Yemen.
Because equipment without doctrine and training is just expensive targets. And that brings us to what might be the most important shift. For most of the 20th century, military power was a function of industrial capacity and manpower. The countries with the biggest factories and the largest populations won. In the 21st century, military power is increasingly a function of software, networks, and speed. A country with 7,000 soldiers and a world-class cyber command can be more strategically significant than a country with 70,000 soldiers and no cyber capability.
The Estonia problem.
The Estonia opportunity, depending on your perspective. And that leaves us with one final question that might define the next decade of defense policy. If capability is decoupling from personnel count, what does the military of 2035 look like? Does a country like Japan finally amend Article 9 and formally recognize what already exists? Does a country like Costa Rica build a drone-based defense force while still claiming to have no army? Does NATO start counting cyber operators in its force, planning the same way it counts infantry battalions?
For the superpowers, the U, China, Russia, the question is whether they can adapt fast enough. A 2-million-person military is an enormous institutional organism. Changing its doctrine, its procurement, its training pipeline, that's like turning an aircraft carrier. Meanwhile, a small country can pivot in a budget cycle.
Is aware of this. The Pentagon's Replicator Initiative is explicitly about fielding thousands of attritable autonomous systems to counter China's numerical advantage. But the institutional resistance is real. Every drone program threatens some general's pet tank program.
The infantryman's job security has never been more uncertain, and there's a deeper tension here that I don't think we've fully grappled with as a society. For two centuries, military service has been tied to citizenship, to national identity, to the social contract. If the military of 2035 is mostly autonomous systems managed by a few thousand cyber operators, what happens to that relationship? Does the public still feel connected to national defense when there are no draft notices, no local bases, no visible human cost?
That's the democratic accountability problem. If war becomes something that happens on screens, conducted by a small technical elite, the public's stake in foreign policy decisions erodes. We already saw this during the drone campaigns of the 20-teens. Airstrikes conducted with zero American casualties generated very little domestic political friction, even when they went on for years. Scale that up to a fully autonomous force structure, and you have to ask, who's actually making the decision to go to war, and who's holding them accountable?
That loops back to the countries with no armies at all. The 23 on our list. They're not weak. They've made a strategic choice. Some of them, like Iceland, have outsourced their defense to an alliance. Some, like Costa Rica, have decided that not having an army is itself a form of security. It signals to neighbors that you're not a threat. And some, like Japan, maintain the fiction of having no army while fielding one of the world's most capable forces. The countries with small armies are not irrelevant either. They're adapting, specializing, and finding ways to be notable without being large.
The question isn't whether you have an army. It's whether your security strategy matches your threat environment. And for a surprising number of countries, the optimal strategy involves zero soldiers.
Which is a counterintuitive thing to say in 2026, with a major land war in Europe and tensions in the South China Sea. But the data supports it. 23 countries have looked at the cost-benefit analysis and decided that a standing army isn't worth it. And many more are realizing that the right question isn't, how many soldiers do we have, but what can our soldiers actually do?
If I had to bet on the next decade, I'd say we're going to see more countries slide toward the Costa Rica end of the spectrum, not necessarily abolishing their armies, but radically shrinking their active forces and reinvesting in cyber, drones, and reserves. The math is just too compelling. Why pay for 10,000 infantry when 1,000 drone operators can cover the same terrain?
Because the 1,000 drone operators can't hold ground. And that's the pushback I'd offer. We've seen in Ukraine that you still need infantry to occupy and hold territory. Drones can attrite, drones can disrupt, drones can make an advance prohibitively expensive. But eventually, if the adversary is willing to absorb the cost, someone has to be there with boots on the ground.
That's the counterpoint, and it's a strong one. The future is probably not. Drones replace infantry, but drones make infantry vastly more effective. A squad with drone support can do what a platoon used to do. A platoon with drone support can do what a company used to do. The personnel count shrinks, but it doesn't go to zero, at least not yet.
The hybrid model, smaller human force, massively augmented by autonomous systems, that's probably where we're heading.
The countries that get there first, the Estonias, the Singapores, the Taiwans, are going to punch so far above their weight class that the old taxonomies won't make sense anymore. We'll need new categories.
Which is a good place to leave it, because the categories are already shifting under our feet. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 1500s, Basque fishermen working the waters off Newfoundland described the structure of their native language's ergative case system as having what they called optical scatter, claiming that the subject of a transitive verb bent the listener's attention differently than the subject of an intransitive verb. The way light bends when it passes through a prism. They insisted you could see the grammatical role if you looked closely enough at the speaker's face.
Right.
I have so many questions about 16th century Basque fishermen's linguistic theories, and I'm going to suppress all of them.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com and on Spotify. We'll see you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.